session number 6818, reel 2.
General Moulton, reel 2. When you were being trained as a pilot at Lucas, were you given any instruction on the theory of the tactics and strategy of air warfare, or was the training
No. We were taught a bit about aircraft maintenance, but not very thoroughly, more theoretically than practically. But nothing as far as I can remember about tactics. In fact, that would have come in the third section of the course. And of course, when we were taught to drop torpedoes at Gosport, we were taught, told, well, we used the standard tactic, fit arm tactic of those times, which was in fact approach high, such as high could be with those airplanes with torpedo on them, dive down to water level. Then you had to get off the speed because the torpedo had to be dropped, I can't remember, about 70 or 80 knots. But even a dart, you see, after a long, steep drive is going faster than that. Then aim off and pull a plug here, and the airplane felt much lighter when that had gone.
How far out from a target were you supposed to start your dive then?
How one?
How far away from the target would you start the dive?
I think probably 800 to 1,000 yards, you do your drop.
How many aircraft would take part in a torpedo ride?
Well, this really takes us into the Mediterranean, where we were part of an active unit, and I was in the Glorious. Her complement of aircraft. She had two fighter. We were flights of six airplanes in those days. That was a fleet arm unit. Two fighter flights, and two reconnaissance flights, and three torpedo flights. So we had 18 torpedo aircraft, and we would do an attack by 18 aircraft. And you had to look where you were going a bit too.
When you made an attack with 18 aircraft, was it generally made in a single line, or was it made in waves?
No, you would really, the rate of speed of a torpedo, you have to attack on the bow. I don't mean straight ahead, I mean the bow and the seagoing parlance, which is in that sector. It's a great help if you get the ship to start turning. So I suppose we weren't all simultaneous, because you could see it. I'm well pictured this day in an R-class battleship. As the attack came in, she'd turn. That would take speed off her. And you would get a much. And you would then try to get on her bow and drop your torpedo in from there.
Did you ever practice the tactic of attacking a ship from more than one direction at
once? Oh, yes. Basically, the ideal situation would be a sort of semicircle, or rather less than a semicircle, around the bow, you see.
So if you could get, say, a.
So whichever way she turned, somebody got about quite half your force to get a bow attack on her. But really, trying to attack after the beam was not very useful. I remember at one time they wanted to, for some reason, they sent a single aircraft to attack one of the county-class cruisers. And I did one of them. Well, the county-class cruiser was steam at 30 knots. And your torpedo only ran at about 40 knots. And if there's only one orbital, really, she just turned her tail, and that was it. And you could, in the clear Mediterranean water, you could watch your torpedo just failing to catch up.
When you started training with torpedo attacks, did you start with static targets at Gosport, or were they always mobile?
Oh no, the very first drops were at a static target, and you had a power boat, a small power boat, which would photograph the drop. I'll show you one. I think I've got one in an album, from which could be measured. You had the height you dropped, you see, and the angle you put the torpedo. You had to drop the torpedo slightly nose down, And so all that could be measured up. The first thing was to learn to get that torpedo away at all, you see. The aiming off was by eye, when we got to that stage. We finished off the course at Gosport with an attack with running torpedoes and collision heads on a light cruiser.
Did you do any training in air gunnery?
Yes, it was a routine part of it. Certainly we did it in the service flights in the Glorious. We had a one Vickers machine gun in front, which you fired the ground target. Quite an interesting experience, because you see, we didn't stir. I dare say with a fighter, much more delicate on the controls. But you could get a reasonable number of hits if you tried hard, if you concentrated hard. And, of course, we did back gunners. They fired out the back, too.
When you were doing these attack exercises, did you ever cooperate with the fighter flights from the carrier?
As far as I remember, the fighters are usually put on the other side. I can remember being caught by them. It really got quite, I won't say exciting, really. They usually were on the on defensive side. We only had one carrier in the fleet most of the time. I do remember when the Home Fleet came out. I was in the Eagle then on my way home in 1935. I think I remember we had two carriers when the Home Fleet came out, say, in the spring of 1932. And so you could put carriers on both sides then. And I think, had three in probably the spring of 1935. And there you would have fighter defense against torpedo attacks, or bombing attacks, too. I think.
How are you supposed to deal with the...
Well, you're supposed to fight it off with a back gun or avoid it if you could. Of course, the ripon would have been absolutely cold meat for, I think, even a fighter of those days. You had a back gun, you had a front gun.
What about the threat from flak?
I would say it was almost non-existent, and it was largely ignored, but I think rightly so. One thing about the Old Fleet Air Arm, light blue, dark blue mixed, was that the Orsino officers were Air Force officers. We had a wing commander in the Glorious. His name was Arnold, who was a World War I fighter pilot. He always used to fly in a peaked cap with his chin stay down. But he used to volunteer. He said, I'll take a fighter or over the fleet, and you can shoot it with anything you've got. I think he'd probably got away with it if it ever happened.
And they never took him up on it?
Nobody ever took him up.
Was there any...
I think probably the gunnery officers knew only too well that he was right.
Was there any friction between the light blue and the dark blue on the...
At Whitehall, yes. In the carrier, I'd say very little. I mean, personalities, of course, always clash. You've got a large number of officers there, and now and again there would be personal clashes. But generally speaking, a thing which is well worth recording is that among the pilots, light blue and dark blue, now both the RAF mess kit and the naval mess kit have a linked button in front. And it's quite a practice for a naval pilot to wear one RAF link and one RN, and he changed with an RAF pilot. And this, it sounds almost improper, but it was just we're all pilots together. As a Marine, I didn't have a link button, so I couldn't do it.
How frequently were you able to fly when you were on the
Well, I think any pilot of the day would say not enough. You probably get about 30 hours a month in the Glorious. But the Eagle on the China station was very bad in that way. One didn't get enough flying.
Yeah, I think you went to the Eagle in 1933.
Yeah.
And where was the Eagle based?
Well, The eagle had just done a long refit, which would take a couple of years, so she was in dockyard hands. We came home, and the Glorious came home to pay off, and Henry Rolfe had married young, got his wife in Malta, and I was adventurous and wanted to use China Station, so we changed over our flights. It was one of the 460 flight, one of the three torpedo flights, was to come home in the Glorious to commission the Eagle. And we landed at Gosport, had some leave. We were then based at Manston for a bit, and we handed in our ribbons and drew three Fs. I don't think we did any special training as reconnaissance pilots. And as far as I remember, the first time I landed three Fs, I can look that up in my logbook, was when we embarked to go east in the Eagle.
So you didn't have a conversion course? You didn't have a conversion course?
No, we didn't, actually. We converted ourselves. There wasn't all, we'd all flown three Fs, you see, at Lucas or elsewhere. We'd all, I think all of us, were experienced deck landing pilots. And of course, you did land a 3F slightly differently than a Ripon. And indeed, the Eagle's deck was slightly different from the Glorious's deck, but it went all right.
I'd like to ask you about deck landings. How did the technique for deck landing differ from the technique for landing on a runway?
Well, to begin with, I told you about the S-turns and all that, but you didn't try it on the deck. It wasn't impossible. You did it as a modern airliner lands. You came in on your throttle. You came up behind the ship, and you hung on your prop, rather, and you had to allow for a certain downdraft over the rundown. You couldn't come too low over the rundown, but you got used to that. You were sort of semi-stalled, and you pull back your throttle and pull back stick, and there you'd be. The great thing was to keep it straight. I've seen several airplanes go over the side in a Carrier. I've never seen one go over the end. I've seen them run into sides and go over. In fact, certainly as torpedo pilots and fighter pilots were the same, that you took a great pride in landing immediately the affirmative, which is a sign you were clear to land, went out. You used to back up, you know your order of landing, you'd back up the chap who landed in front of you, so that if he got there too soon, you'd take it over, take the landing over. Then you'd start a turn. When you saw he'd landed, you'd start a turn. Now, as you saw him start down the lift, you'd start your turn to go right round to 180 degrees and back along the stern here, come in hanging on your prop, hoping you've got it right, watching for that affirmative to come out, and trying to be just in position to drop it on the deck as the landing came. And in a torpedo flight, why I say torpedo flight and fighter flights, you see, the reconnaissance people were much more likely to, much less likely to do a flight landing. We were always tended to be landing in flights coming back from a torpedo attack.
Was there a great deal of emphasis in the training on getting flights off quickly and getting them back on quickly?
Yes. There's nothing much in getting off. We would range up the whole of the 18 ribbons, you see, turn into wind, and then you'd go off one after the other.
How long do you think it would take to get the 18 off?
It's awfully difficult to tell. The impression was it wasn't very long, but just how long it took you to get up speed, rumble down the deck, and then you had to wait. They had to wait a moment. There's a little steam jet right at the forward end of the flight deck. And of course, that was disturbed by the airflow from slipstream, and they'd wait till that was coming down the deck again straight, and then the next one would get the flag signal, off he'd go. I suppose it must have been probably longer than it felt like.
And it obviously took longer to land them back on and get them clear.
Well,
they
had to be struck down the lift, you see. These were really primitive deck. We weren't the really primitive deck landers. They had wires along the deck, not across the deck. It's rather surprising to think of now. And about the time I did my air acquaintance course, which was in the Furious in about 1930, I think, they were just about landing on a cleared deck. So we had, of course, no wheel brakes. The two-wheel carriage, tail skid in the back. So you came up like that. In fact, you relied on stopping the airplane by as the tail went down, so the resistance to the wings increased, and you relied on that. You had a good wind over the deck, you see, and one never really worried about falling off over the end.
So your aim was to get yourself the right speed so you could plonk down on the deck and be stopped
by the air resistance, yes. I once landed a 3F with a 17 knot wind speed, and I must say that was an emergency landing. I was having trouble with my engine, and I was a bit anxious then, I must confess, but never in doubt, really. Normally you'd land about something over 20 knots wind speed.
How did they actually train you to do a deck landing?
Well, they marked out a deck on the airfield.
At Lucas.
And you would practice this approach on the engine. Now, after that, normally you went out and did one, but they just got round to it when we did our deck landings, that before you were turned loose on your service type, you did two or three deck landings dual with an instructor in an Avro. And I must say that in my case, I'm sure it was very useful. I got the idea then. I was rather clumsy the first time round. I suddenly got the idea of sticking to those white lines. You had to keep a straight along those white lines.
And that was done by eye?
By eye. Well, it's very easy, I mean. You know what those decks looked like, one big one down the middle. And you got those in eye and took them right like a railway line, froze onto that.
It sounds as though the flying was virtually all done by feel rather than by using instruments.
Oh, no. We had all aeroplanes from a very early stage had the bubble, which was the thing that tells you when you're level.
Like a spirit level.
Spirit level, yes, it was. It was a bowed spirit level like that. And one of the things you had to learn was to do a turn and keep that bubble central.
But you could presumably eventually feel that through the controls as you were.
I think one. Yes, there was a lot of. It was in the days when the change was coming, a lot of pilots talked about doing it all by feel. I suspect most people did it with a glance at the bubble to see if it was all right. And of course, you had an altimeter, and you had an airspeed indicator. Now, in the time between the Glorious and the Eagle, the whole flight did a blind flying course, where you had a turn and bank indicator as well. And we did it in pairs. It went back to Avro, actually, dual control Avro. One chap doing safety pilot in front, the other chap under the hood. You couldn't land them. You could take off blind.
And what was the idea behind this? Was it to train you to fly at night?
Largely to fly through cloud.
Through cloud.
Low cloud, you see. Because the bubble is not... can do all sorts of odd things. And the forces acting on an airplane... the bubble is a very useful check when you could see a horizon. But... it could do odd things to you if you couldn't see a horizon, if you didn't know what you were doing.
But I would assume that
the turn indicator, you see, you could. Turn and bank indicator really gave you something positive.
I assume that you were more or less limited to flying in daylight.
There was a certain amount went on of night flying. Mm-hmm. I just missed my night deck landings in the Glorious, and there were, I think, more experienced pilots doing, and I did some in the Eagle.
What about limitations imposed by weather?
Well, you really tried to. The limitation was you could fly through cloud, but you didn't. You had to be fairly confident. There was some clear sky between, or clear air between you and the surface. So you tend to be full above cloud. I mean, you go up through cloud without thinking twice about it. If you came to a level of cloud, I remember doing this solo in Avro, and it's a very exhilarating experience, which one hadn't, because nowadays everyone's been an airliner, but you come up, it gets darker and darker and darker, you've got more and more, not really dark, but gloomy. Then you go into cloud and you hold a straight and climb in, and then suddenly you burst out into the sunlight above. Well, everyone knows it now, but it means it's the first time when you were flying. It was quite interesting. Then at sea, of course, you didn't have to worry about high ground, so you kept below the clouds, unless you were doing a torpedo attack or something.
What about rain? Was that an impediment to flying?
Just go on through it. Rather. You'd often hit a bit of rain. Snow, you occasionally hit in a cloud, and that could be rather more. Certainly without blind flying equipment, I think we should be careful with that. Oh, I mean, you deck land in the rain. You have to. I mean, there you were. It was raining on the ship.
Can I ask you a bit about China? Now, you went out to China as a substitute for your colleague who was married. How did you get out there? Was it on the Eagle?
In the Eagle. We landed on in the Solent, off the Isle of Wight somewhere. And there we were. Off we went.
How long did it take the Eagle to get out to China?
How long?
Yes.
Well, I can tell you, by reference to my logbook. Well, you want to say it again?
Yes, if you could say how long it took approximately to get out to China.
Yes, my first deck landing on the Eagle, which was my 81st deck landing, was on the 26th of March, 1933. I did three more deck landings the next... two more deck landings the next day, and then on the 29th, I see under heading en route for China, I've got another deck landing for an exercise. On passage for China, we couldn't do deck landings because you had to have a crash vessel ship behind you, normally it would be a destroyer.
But you didn't have an escort then on the way
to China. Didn't have an escort. On the 3rd of May, we were off Cape St. Vincent formation practice. We must have picked up a destroyer there. Then we picked up a destroyer at Malta because I've got done North Coast of Africa DF trials, formation to Malta and back. We went and shot up the airfield to show we'd come. So we must have had a destroyer. Maybe we had a destroyer all the way out to Malta. Then after that...
So you actually went through the canal?
We went through the canal, and then there's no more, not another entry in my logbook until the 3rd of June off Singapore. And there we had an RAF rescue launch acting as a safety vessel. And there were quite a number. We landed at the RAF base at Kai Tak, and then flew back from the Kai Tak to Eagle. Now that's the time I said it was 18 knots of wind. I had a magneto failure. And then the next time after we'd left, off Hong Kong, we took off and went to Kai Tak. I'll tell you about Kai Tak in a moment. The next time entry is on the 20th of June, when we're off Wei Hai Wei. We must have picked up a destroyer there. What I was going to say about Kai Tak is that I think it was in 1968, I went to Hong Kong as defense correspondent for the Tasker Herald. And really, it was quite remarkable. In 1933 and indeed in 1935, Kai Tak was a very small airfield on a little sandy soil, reclaimed soil, surrounded by hills, except on one side, which was the harbor. And in the summer weather, the weeds used to grow to about 2 or 3 feet high. We were warned about this and said, oh, land a little lower than you think. The ground was so soft that if you stopped taxiing, you couldn't start again without somebody sitting on the tail.
You'd just sink in, would you?
You sunk in. And so a couple of aircraft hands have to come running out all the way from the tarmac, sit on your tail. That wasn't very popular. So when you landed, you tried to keep a taxiing until you got on the tarmac. Then when you left the tarmac, you tried to keep a taxiing until you could take off. And then to go back and see this in 1968, well, the Ministry of Buildings are just about where our landing strip was, and that was all. And to see this great runway out into the harbour taking modern four-engine airplanes was really quite surprising. The remarkable thing was you could still recognise bits of it from the air. So that's how long it took us to get to China from the... What did I say? About a month, you see.
Once you got out into Chinese waters, where was the main base from which you were operating?
Hong Kong. Fleet was based on Hong Kong with a summer station at Wei Hai Wei. You spent most of the summer at Wei Hai Wei.
What was the normal work of the fleet out in Chinese waters at that time?
Well, they were maintaining a presence, really. They were based on four county class cruisers. I think it was four. One of which was the fleet flagship. We had what would now be called a squadron of sloops. In those days, it was called a flotilla. There must have been a destroyer flotilla. And of course, there were the gunboats on the Yangtze. That was the essence of it all.
How much of the time did you actually spend at sea?
Not very much, really. You tended during exercise periods, which would go out for most of the week. Of course, again, we got very little flying because there was no airfield there. And therefore, we were all flying. Nearly all flying was from the carrier, but. The fleet aircraft of those days could be converted to float planes. And we used to keep one aircraft per flight on floats.
This was to keep up the rate of flying, was it?
To do odd jobs. Because we were working with the fleet, you see. For example, we often had to spot for a cruiser's chute. And so if the Eagle wasn't at sea, then she didn't have to take the whole carrier to sea. And sometimes, in fact, I remember at least one occasion when being left in Wei Hai Wei with a float plane and my observer and a telegraphist, we'd be made fast to a buoy, and when we were required for exercises at sea, we'd take off and come back and land there. It was quite an experience getting a float plane off in hot weather on a sea which had a lot of Chinese fishing boats on it.
You had to find a
straight line into wind. And